Hi, this is Joe Van Wee, your host of All Better. I had a few announcements. If you're interested in subscriber content, which we're about to launch, this would be STEP workshops, cognitive behavioral therapy tools, and mindfulness practices that are approachable and can be very useful in reducing anxiety, rumination, and depression. Please send us a message on Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn. And if you like the episodes that you've been hearing very much, please stop by Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star rating and a small review. This helps us stay relevant in the field of content and helping people and their families with substance use disorder. Thank you. Hello, and thanks again for listening to another episode of All Better. I'm your host, Joe Van Wee. Today's guest is a friend. His name is Kirk Larkin. Kirk resides up in Maine. And Kirk is a very interesting element in finding treatment. He acts as a liaison for educators and families to find young men treatment in a continuum of care that can last anywhere from 30 days to a year. In evaluating the quality of that treatment after spending 2 decades in the field, Kirk comes on today to discuss his own personal recovery, what produced that, what his mission is and his drive when serving families and helping other people find quality treatment and recovery throughout New England area and beyond. We also discuss the rise of body brokering, a few other ugly topics that happen to be scenarios in the drug and alcohol field. So Kirk has great insight in that. He likes calling it out, and he hates bullies. It's great to catch up with Kirk, and I'm excited for you to meet him. Let's meet Kirk Larkin. We're here with Kirk Larkin. I haven't seen Kirk in 2 years. We had dinner up in Maine a couple years back, and I wanted to reach out because Kirk just responded to someone in need for me, a friend whose son was in complete distress from addiction. And Kirk, to me, before I introduce you, is like the New England recovery fixer for me. If there's anything, you know, north of New York, I don't know who to call except Kirk, because you've been in sobriety for decades now, and you've been in this field. But I think to start, Kirk, who are you? How'd you enter recovery?
So, hi, Joe. And we did have dinner 2 years ago, and it was very enjoyable. We've been in touch since. And New England fixer, that's an honor. Thank you. And that you trust me with people that need help. And so, yeah, I'm an alcoholic. That's what I call myself. And I have a disease. And it basically what it looks like is I have this physical allergy to alcohol and other mind-altering substances. And when I take one of any of them, I just can't tell you with any certainty what's going to happen to me. And I typically take more than I plan to and end up in a place I don't want to be in. And then I've had a lot of experience going to different treatment centers for that because it caused a lot of problems in my life. And I struggled with getting sober, staying sober. I could get sober for short periods of time. And, you know, I've got another problem that once I get sober, in a rehab or a detox or both or whatever, I seem to forget all of those things that happened to me that led me there. And I take another drink or whatever else. And it leads to the same thing. So at one point I was facing a lot of consequences for my standards, a ton. And I was very, very scared. And I knew it was a direct result of drinking and doing drugs. And that's a part of my story too. So I went to a treatment center again, a detox first, and then a treatment center again. And for some reason, I met a group of people. They were a good group of people. Thank God they were there, which this will come into play later, but because I want everybody to get treatment for free, but that's not possible. These people were being paid to administer treatment, and thank God that they were. And I went there, and they talked in a way that I had never heard anybody speak before. I think it was just where I was at, and they're a good group of people. And I got a slight shred of hope. They told me we were going to do some things, and I didn't quite believe that they were going to work for me. But the way that they were talking and the way they appeared to me, I in my gut, I was like, these people were like me or worse, and they're better now. So maybe I better listen. And I started slowly listening. Anyway, long story short, I finished that program. It was like 30 days. And then I was about to do what I always do, which is go right home in my late 20s, which would mean home was my parents' house. And I was told that I wasn't welcome there. And I got sent up to Portland, Maine. And I was told I should live in a sober house. And the way that I accepted that was it was my only choice. It was that or the street. So I took the sober house. And that's where I went on this long, drawn out journey where the entire time I was walking this journey, I really didn't understand what was happening to me. I couldn't see it at the moment. And I was, you know, scared and sad and sometimes happy and hopeful. And I took this long journey. I joined a fellowship, and it's one that I believe in. And I just started taking action. And I've learned to kind of articulate what that looked like. I didn't know this is what I was doing. I didn't say it this way back then, but I take the right action despite how I feel. And I realized that is what counts, that I have to take action. This is about chopping wood and carrying water. And sometimes I take action and I don't really feel the direct results of it. I don't sometimes even see why I have to do it. It's uncomfortable, but I know from experience that's what I have to do, and it works. And what I tell people a lot is the results that I've gotten is, so my sober date is January 1st, 2006.
Okay.
And, during that time of sobriety, I have felt better than any high that I've ever experienced in my life. Not higher, but better than any high I've ever experienced in my life. I've also felt in sobriety so low that I started asking myself why I was bothering doing this. But what I can report is most of the time, I generally feel okay. And that's a drastic change from the first, let's say, you know, 28 years of my life. And so now I'm up here in Portland, Maine, and my mission in life is to, I've got work experience in different industries and things. I've got some treatment industry experience. I know a lot of people in the treatment industry. There's people that I was roommates with in rehab that own rehabs now. And, you know, the list goes on. And I've watched a lot of people go through this process. And my goal in life, my purpose is to be available to help addicts and alcoholics and or their loved ones when they are in need of finding a treatment center. And what I would like to do is give them a candid, honest, neutral, unbiased peek into what they can expect. And I'm clear with them. It's based on my experience and the experience I've observed. And they can take it for what it is. And then there's other parts of it as well. I'll do literally anything that I can to help someone that wants help, because I understand that this disease is so powerful that when you get this moment where the person who is at risk of dying wants help, they've got to get the help. And so that's my goal. I can't help everybody, and you know, I can only do so much, but it's my goal and my purpose.
Well, I just experienced that firsthand. A friend was in need. They're friends up in New England. And the clearness and the concise statement you made to them wasn't to validate that they're going to be comfortable through this experience. You kind of just stated objective facts. You're not alone. I'm here to tell you this is common. And you gave them a clear response of what they could do as family members, irregardless of the other person getting sober at that point. And so I just wanted to touch on that. The support you showed that family was, it was sincere. It's real. It's not cliche. You weren't, it's not like a sales pitch. You're telling them the hard realities. This could go a couple different ways, but here's what you can do to protect yourself. So, but some of the themes, and I think that's why we get along, is because they're clear. You tell your story in such a clear way, but it has all the themes of what I define as recovery, what that fellowship that we're both kind of biased and a part of. But you see these themes across the board, even outside of our fellowship, of what produces recovery. And the first thing you said was, we have memory problems, and it's not like a cognition, like a you're not developed in memory. It's like an emotional switch that goes off that doesn't allow you to remember consequences. Like the neurological story would be, I can't measure risk and reward. I don't get to my frontal lobe. I have a discomfort, or I have too much happiness, and it creates this safety that I can return to the addiction that's always worked. Irregardless of what, like a week before that, you were in a psych unit or something. Like you're like, okay, this is different because, you know, I have an iron shirt on. I'm going to drink differently. So that's one theme. And that theme, I think people who have recovery communities in their life, you can't have it without understanding that about your own addiction, that this is a problem I definitely can't solve by myself because of that distinct problem that I'm under threat at any time to return to addiction because of a lie, or I can't think properly. Like when thinking about euphoria, and you said something real interesting, you can withstand pain, depression, the ups and downs of life, but underneath all that, you knowing it's okay is because you found a purpose that seems good and bad times together, that the solution to them is not pleasure. It's belief, it's faith, it's connection. Those themes, I don't know where recovery exists without those themes.
I agree with you. And, you know, I came to this conclusion just based on talking to other people in the fellowship that I'm in and other people that are in recovery. But I've been seeing it. I think it was some article, potentially Forbes or something like that. But they're asking the question, because people are always seeking it out, what makes human beings happy? And clearly, or to me anyway, clearly there's a shortage of happiness outside of addiction as well. There's a shortage of happiness. And this article, you know, and it drew my attention because the first thing it said was, do you think it's money? And they did say, that there's some benefits that come with financial success that can help you to be a little bit more satisfied. But truly, what human beings need is connection and purpose, which I believe are two words you just used. And I found that to be true. If I do not have a purpose, it's hard for me to be happy. And I think human beings are innately born that way. We need some kind of purpose, and it's usually related to community and connection. And that's what this fellowship gives me. And I wanted to talk about, I want to mention, because it's part of my disease, I'm going to use the word spiritual, which I used to recoil when I heard that word, spirituality. And I think I thought it was the same thing as religion, which it's not. And I also thought that there was one very siloed definition that was something my parents or grandparents came up with or something like that. Mm-hmm. But that's not true. It's a very open, kind of pick your own flavor type of thing. And a big part of my disease, and this, I always tell people, I said, I white knuckled it until I was about 13. And then I took my first drink. Right. And people laugh, especially the fellowship that I,
I don't think I've heard that. I've been around since I'm 16 in and out. I've white knuckled it until I was 13. Holy. Yeah. Oh, that's
great. And then I took my first drink. And what that really, and probably why you're chuckling, is because that shows that there was something going on with me well before I took a drink. And I'm not saying that I or we are unique or other people don't go through these things, but there is this experience that I hear other people talk about. It seems similar to mine when they get to a place where they can articulate it, because it took me a while to be able to explain what was happening with me. And So I have this spiritual malady, a lot of people call it. And here's how I like to describe it. It's important, and hopefully it helps somebody out there. But or even for loved ones, it might explain behaviors from their loved ones that they can't seem to understand because they're applying logic and reason to something that doesn't fit logic and reason. So my spiritual malady, the way that it looks for me is when I wake up in the morning everything inside me, and I don't know why, but everything inside me just naturally kind of leans or points towards taking shortcuts, lying, cheating, doing anything but having like an open, honest, upfront conversation with people. I like to grab things that are really easy to get and they burn out quickly. I can rarely maintain connections with other people for long periods of time. I find the normal day-to-day things that I see a lot of other people seemingly do with relative ease to have a decent life absolutely excruciating, you know? Yeah. And that's just the way I was born and that's the way I lean. And so what I found is I had to find some kind of spiritual path and help from others to change that, to change that where I come from. And the last thing, and then I'll stop this train of thought, but what happens for me is, you know, if I am in a place, because this is about not drinking and not doing drugs for people, but for me, it's also about changing the way that I live. And a lot of normal people, when they ask me about my, oh, you don't drink, and they, oh, you must be, you know, this must be tough for you, because they think that what I'm doing is I'm still very attracted to alcohol and drugs and living a life that's full of dishonesty and cutting corners and not being connected with people. But I'm strong and I've gained this willpower where I don't indulge in any of those things. Yeah. It's actually not the truth. I wish I was that strong of a person. What's happened to me is something changed inside of me during this process, which kind of is related to what I believe treatment is. It's a longer term thing. Something changed, and those things, for the most part, no longer look attractive to me, yeah. Right? Like, so when I wake up in the morning, I don't have a fist fight with myself of whether I'm going to make my bed. Not that that's the most important thing, but I don't have a fist fight with myself of whether or not I'm going to make my bed, which takes about 11 seconds, which I used to do. It's attractive to me to turn around and make my bed. So when I come home, it's made, you know, those kind of little things, and it expands in other areas as well. Being dishonest, like there's times that it's very easy to be dishonest and it's not even seemingly meaningful at the time. It's not over a big thing. But what's happened is I'm no longer attracted to being dishonest. It's unattractive to me. So I typically tell the truth. Typically, there's been times I've been dishonest and I quickly run back and write that shit too.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hello, my name is Joe Van Wee. I'm the host of All Better. I'm also the CEO of Fellowship House. At Fellowship House, we believe long-term recovery requires a personality change as well as a clinical intervention. These ideas can take several months to achieve. Our philosophy is to provide a safe, therapeutic, and exceedingly active environment for patients to achieve these personality changes and find joy in the fellowship of recovery, which will allow for long-term sobriety. We believe that recovery extends beyond treatment and peer-to-peer communities into real life. In Fellowship House, we provide a design for living that focuses on education and service. We have strong relationships with the 12 universities and vocational schools in the area and assure that our fellows pursue their personal goals while entering sobriety. We also stress independence and responsibility, making sure each individual is financially solid and self, and helping to make their community a better place. As a treatment center, Fellowship House offers both residential and outpatient treatment services to individuals and families affected by addiction and alcoholism. We're a DDAP licensed provider of general outpatient, intensive outpatient, and partial hospitalization programming, as well as a level of care assessments. If you want to find out more information about Fellowship House, please visit fellowshiphouses.com.
Dude, it's weird. Spirituality, it's such a catch-all phrase, and I used to cringe at it too. I've had different relationships with the word. And I thought it demanded unjustifiable beliefs, or I have to join a group that is doing things I don't feel are accessible to me. Like I'm going to have to fake this too, and then I'll get better. I have to lie into recovery. Yes, I believe. But you said something real interesting. It's about chopping wood earlier and carrying the water. So, and that you can have this broader highway. It's not about a proof for God or the divine. Let's caveat that. You're in big trouble. I'm not sure what your God or what you want to choose is, but I know you can do these four things and it might produce this result. And all you're asking before that is something spiritual that seems not, you know, innate to someone who has fear. Like me, being dishonest and wanting to take shortcuts is out of almost this driving engine of terror that I don't even articulate it. It's just there winding me. Yeah. And in that fellowship in the 30s that we're talking about, that's the first description that alcohol is relieving him of a problem that already existed. He had loneliness. He has dread, anxiety, this unbridled ambition. To me, I don't see ambition. I see anxiety. I'll prove to the world I'm important, the founder of AA said. But, and alcohol was going to help him do this. Why does the world need to know that? So I think the alcoholics are my type, and we're kind of cut from the same cloth and our rapport, and you meet each other. And you're like, no, alcohol, you know, it's not the direct evil. It was the first solution. And letting go of that's really scary, even though I'm paying consequences. Logically, I could see, this is because I'm an alcoholic. And this is because I'm addicted to drugs. But it's hard to pivot with someone that doesn't fully understand yet. No, that was the first solution. It's failed you. Yeah. It'll kill you. There's something else. But like you have to breadcrumb it into them. You don't want to terrify someone. Right?
No. But Joe, that's exactly what I say. All alcohol was the first solution that I stumbled upon that got to a point where it no longer worked for me because it caused such havoc in my life. But it was a solution. Yeah. I just walked into it blindly.
I always kind of missed that message. I didn't hear it because sometimes you hear conflicting messages or just the way people are trained to talk in 12-step groups. You know, they're great people, but sometimes they have a persona in the meeting and you're like, that's not the guy I just had coffee with. He's just, you kind of go into this hypnosis and parakeet, whatever you have, but it's all fun. I mean, you just get used to it. So out of curiosity, did you have siblings?
I do, yeah. So I have one older brother who is, he's with us.
All right.
Yeah, he's with us.
He's a Jedi.
Yeah, he is, yeah. And I, you know, later in life, we kind of, you know, ran together back in the day, let's say. And then at one point, I kind of made this decision that I was going to apply myself to this work. And I was successful at it. At least in the measure that I'm sober and abstinent. And he didn't. And so he struggled lately. And I was heavily involved in helping him get treatment. And so that was another thing that I can offer of value to people. Because you know what happened, Joe? It took me like 6 or 7 years. I'm a big talker and I have to be really careful. Yeah. I like to say, I think Socrates said it, but I love it. It's Plato or Socrates. The only thing I'm sure of is that I'm not sure of anything at all. Yeah. And I need to like stay in that kind of place because I'm a big talker. I like, you know, I like people to think that, you know, I want people to like me and all of this stuff, but it took me 5 or 6 years in sobriety. But the only thing that I'm truly qualified to speak about is my own experience.
Wow.
And one of the things that I can offer to family members is I've been the person, and I've been around the people in treatment and in the fellowship that I'm in, but I've also been the family member at the center of a brutal set of circumstances regarding addiction and older parents who've already put them through the lumber mill. And so they're kind of like done. And, you know, all of a sudden I looked around and it's my older brother and then two younger sisters. And I was like, it's me and my sisters, my parents. The way that they're talking, they want to help, but I don't think they can. It's not like I just call dad. That's over. And it was very scary. And all of a sudden I'm like, I've been through all of this and I've got all this experience. And now this is a reality for me, very close to me. And it was terrifying. And I did my best to apply everything that I've learned, but I didn't always do that. And I needed help from someone else to give me, you know. So anyway, to answer your question, though, sorry, I've got an older brother, and then I have a sister who is 4 years younger than me and another sister that's 8 years younger than me.
Yeah.
Yep.
I'm a talker too. We're on a podcast. That's how much I talk. I know. There's the power in personal experience. I'm the expert in my personal experience, and I think that means something a little more. It has a deeper quality when you're in, say, the practice of 12 steps or another recovery community, that you're speaking of your own experience almost as this new third person looking back at it. And you can articulate that when I wake up, I look for shortcuts. Well, what is that other, what can that be other than spirituality? It's existential. It's this ability to observe the most uncomfortable parts of you. That takes a really enormous personality change for someone to speak even of themselves that way, the way you just spoke about going through family crisis, without hubris or this confidence I'm in charge, but I'm going to be here as me. I'm not running. I could show you. I've had an experience. I've recovered from addiction, and the way you describe it, that is spirituality to me. Well, I don't know what else it could be. Unless you go into the realm of fantasy.
Yeah.
But
you mentioned personality change. I think that's the term that you used. And that is a very common term that's used all of the time. And that's what happened to me. Something changed. And the tough part for explaining it to someone who's new or going through it is I could not identify when that was happening at the time that it was happening, which is difficult because a lot of times, especially when you're very uncomfortable and people are telling you to do these things that you don't necessarily, they weren't your idea. So that's strike one. They're usually uncomfortable, like, you know, leave places better than you found it, face up to your past transgressions, be honest, like these kind of things. And you're just like, oh, here we go. It's very difficult to do those things that are so uncomfortable and then not see a direct result almost immediately. That's what I wanted. And that's not what happened. But something happened over time and there was a change, personality change. Yeah.
It's a diminishment of self. And, you know, some of the philosophers I enjoy or physicists or clinicians that are more of the modern age say the self doesn't exist. Like there's nowhere you could point to self. It's an illusion we have to manufacture in our heads to feel that we're operating through a three-dimensional world, all this kind of jazz. But in the simpler terms, our self is filled with pain and it's on this loop, feedback loop. And when that self kind of crumbles and I commit to the group, like you just said, I could have a new operating plan, like paying debts, apologizing, considering others, even if it feels phony at first, you almost have to practice yourself into it.
Yeah.
This will produce those results of personality change. And what it does is you're part of something bigger that, you know, like you're in New England. I'm from Pennsylvania. We met a couple of years ago, but we're part of something together. In this, like we share the same language, and that we should live by the same principles, and we could bend each other's ears at a moment notice that I'm struggling with this. That's a spiritual organization. That's a good group to be a part of. That being said, how did you get drawn into, you know, how would you describe your position in the recovery field and how it's changed over the last couple of years?
So for the recovery field and treatment, my view, and this is my personal view based on my experience, is that, my own personal experience and then watching a lot of other people go through this is that, detox and treatment or rehab is usually the term that a lot of people use. that's typically, you know, 5 to 7 days for detox, depending on your situation or if you need it at all. And then, you know, 25, 30 days, there's 60 days now, but it's a length of time that's typically no more than a month and a half at best, maybe 2 months. And what I've come to realize is that very little, so a lot happened to me as far as the direction I was pointed in that treatment time, that I went to a detox and then I went to a 30-day treatment center. A lot happened to me as far as the direction I was pointed in. And I believe that it was a result of the people around me and I heard some things, but I don't really know, Joe. I don't know how much of it was I was in a different place or these people said something different that I hadn't heard before, or they said the same thing and I just wasn't listening. I don't know.
But it's hard to parse sometimes.
But what I do know is I didn't change much in those first 30 days. I didn't. And so where that brings me is why in the treatment world, there's so much put on that first 30 days. It doesn't really connect for me. And so the reason that I'm saying that is I believe that as long as a treatment center, there's medical stuff that has to be taken care of. And that's up to the person that's going there and the people that are receiving them, that the proper medical and professional staff are there. That's a whole different story. But as far as the treatment aspect, as long as you have a place where you know the people there have integrity, the facility is sufficient, the food is decent, doesn't have to be a 5-course meal, although those places, 5-star meal, those places exist.
Yeah, they're nice to visit.
You can pet horses and play bocce if you want. And that might help. I'm not saying those things don't help. It's just, a matter of cost for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. But, as long as the place is decent, it's reputable, they do what they say they're going to do, and they have a decent program with professionals there that are required for the people that are there, I would say that's the way to choose a place to go. Because, and the reason I'm saying that is what's changed a lot in the treatment industry is the internet. And what's happening right now? So there's referral, referral systems that I'm not an expert on, mm-hmm. but there's referral systems where people work together, and there's good and bad in that. The good in it is, hey, and I was involved in that stuff when I worked in treatment. It's like, I know this therapist at this treatment center, and I trust this person because every person they've sent me is a good fit for the program that I work at. And that's good for everybody. It's good for the kid. It's good for the parent's pocketbook or whoever's footing the bill. It's honest. There's integrity behind it. And then for me, passing that person on, if they're going to go on to another, sober house or something like that, I know the person's because I know what's going on in their facility. It can also be bad because not everybody's making referrals for those reasons that I just stated.
Yeah.
So it's good and bad. But what the other way that people enter into treatment now is they simply go on Google and say, my husband is a heroin addict and needs rehab or whatever term. Yeah. That's a term. And unfortunately, to show up in a Google search, when you type these terms that normal people use when they're trying to help their loved one, whoever pays the most shows up at the top. There's organic search stuff at the bottom, but at the top, it's whoever pays the most.
Yeah.
They show up. And I can tell you that in my opinion, the people that are paying the most are not necessarily the best. Yeah. And they definitely can't say that they're the best for every individual that's stumbling upon their advertisement. Right?
I think that's the key importance, not everyone either, because they're just dominating intel.
Yes.
We have two, I could think of two monsters without naming them. Just
me that, as well.
You could type in one word, addiction, yep. rehab, treatment. They're coming up for every one of them. And that first page would be the same probably in 30 states.
Yeah. So here's another layer to it, Joe. The way that they're doing that as well, because there's restrictions around bidding for those terms, right? And there's this third party that Google's hired to meet these government requirements because of past, body brokering and things like that.
Yeah.
And
real quick, how would you just, and then we come back to that point, what would you describe body brokering as if someone didn't understand?
So body brokering is when, and it's always not good. But especially with like insurance or public insurance, it's really, you know, so body, for me, body brokering would be, you make an arrangement with a treatment center and the treatment center says, hey, send me people and mm-hmm. I will pay you X dollars for each person that you send me. And that is not legal to do, yeah. But you can, you know, there's ways that you can do it and people try to do it and not get caught, but
it's legal in Saudi Arabia though. It's legal in Saudi Arabia. It's legal in Saudi Arabia.
No, everything's legal in Saudi Arabia if you have enough money.
Except drinking, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Even that is if you, you know.
Yeah, exactly. If you're elite.
Don't leave the compound.
But so this is like a kind of a practice of an industry. It would essentially be called bribery, maybe in other industries, yeah. And bribery. Paying for heads to beds. Yeah. I've heard that term before too.
Yeah.
What is the unethical approach is this at no point really is clinical or that individual's treatment plan or mental health issues a consideration. You're just meeting quotas with this referral system.
Yeah. So I had an experience because I've done a lot of research and I had an experience, which I guessed would have been the case. And I ended up being correct. So one of the tactics used by some of these monsters that are outbidding everybody and spending millions of dollars every quarter to show up first to a lot of unsuspecting people that think, oh, this must be the best because that's what Google shows me.
Sure.
You said they might show up first in 30 different states. Well, the way that they're doing that is they're developing these, they're cheap to make, these platforms and what it looks like, and forgive me, but it's a good comparison. It looks like the price line of treatment centers. So they're disguising themselves as this, here, come on my website and look at all these different treatment centers, not just mine.
Yeah.
But if you pay attention, you can't do much from there. Like you can't communicate. You can take the phone number and call the treatment center, but that's it. And then this typically highlighted large 800 number like follows you around the page and gets in your way. And if you click on it and read the fine print, it says this phone number will go to a call center for X company. And we will only talk to you about our 5 treatment centers. But nobody reads that. And then you call, and this is the experience I had, and it answers the question that you said about people's individual, like, what do they need clinically? Yeah. And like, what kind of support do they need? And really just making sure that this person's going somewhere, and it's expensive, and it's for good reason a lot of the time, but that it's a good fit for them. And it's going to be, I forgive the expression, but the best bang for their dollar, because dollars are finite. What the experience I had is I called the phone number multiple times. And what I got was a person on the other end of the line. I felt like I reached boiler room. The only question that he asked me in the beginning was, what's my insurance? What's my insurance? What's my insurance? And he was trying to gauge basically how much I was worth. I was told there's only treatment centers in these certain states. And then here's the thing that I disliked the most that shows, it illustrates what we're talking about. I said to him at one point, it was very aggressive. And I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. And I said, I'm from New England and I have children. I was saying I need to go to treatment. And I'm from New England and I have children and I don't want to leave the New England area. Can you get me into a place in New England? Because again, I've looked at this website with 500 treatment centers, a lot of them in New England. And he said to me, he laughed and he said, there are no beds available in New England. You're going to have to come to one of ours.
Yeah,
there's more to it, which I don't have to get into, but the more aggressive things you're going to.
That's the beginning of the grossness. So just to summarize what you're saying. Yeah. So we talked about body brokering and this is this closed network of referrals and it's kind of off the books. It could be an exchange of cash or, quick quid pro quo between two levels of care, detoxes, inpatient treatments, PHPs or OPs, or even recovery houses. So this is happening, but then coupled with technology in the last 15 years, this explosion and control of how search engines will give you results for drug and alcohol treatment. And this is, you're seeing conglomerates kind of rise up. Some of these companies are publicly traded. that owned, you know, they had, could have up to 70,000 employees. I was looking at one, like Acadia, and they're big.
Yeah.
But I'm not saying they're part of this game. But when you search for drug and alcohol treatment, of a list of the top 30 words any common person would think of for alcoholism or treatment or help, I need help, you're getting these single players, but they disguise themselves as multiple sites. They look like review pages almost, or like, we'll tell you the value. We're going to compare five of these together, but it's really pushing. It's a Trojan horse for their boiler room, essentially, is what you got in touch with. And even these boiler rooms, they might not be the company directly. They could be third party kind of call centers, right? Just hounding people into rehab.
Yes, that's what they are.
And this, and
one of the loopholes is, so you can't send somebody to a treatment center and receive a kickback, is what they call it, for that. But what you can do is take somebody who's not committed to a treatment center and send that lead, to use a cold sales term, because that's what it is, to send that lead to a call center. And that's another way that people are making a lot of money. They're pricing out the bidding. They're doing a cost and price model and saying, here's how much we got to spend to get this amount of clicks. And then this is how many calls it'll produce. And that's what we're going to charge for calls. And there's your business model, you know?
Yeah. And this business model is down to almost these magic numbers of a return. Mm-hmm. How much are you cost per bed, cost per head? And that includes operations and marketing costs. The fellowship I was introduced to, and the virtues and principles of recovery in the way I live it in the community I'm connected with, it's really jarring. I like this field, but I've just become literate to this side of it in the last year. I was blown away. It's strange to you see this language even being used, or see people talk this way, especially if they're in this industry and they're not in recovery. It kind of makes me angry. I'm like, man, when was the last time you were on Medicaid or thrown out of school or humiliated, lost your job, and then you're being talked about as if you're a lead? Like, it's just fucking gross, man.
My heart rate's gone up since we started this conversation because I'm passionate about it. And Joe, I want to repeat, you know, I believe that I'm alive today, and I have a beautiful 5-year-old son and a wonderful life, because people were being paid and charging money to administer treatment. I'm so thankful that that's the case. So that's not what this is about. That is a must, and it needs to continue. I think more money should be spent. What the issue is when you are going, when someone needs to go to treatment, is the information they're being given, is it accurate? And are they being properly handled? Are they being talked to and making sure that this is the right fit for them? Because in a lot of cases, you know, treatment's expensive.
Yeah, it is.
And either people have insurance and they can only make so many claims, or they have limited cash reserves. And as I mentioned before, I believe it's a longer process and there's more money that needs to be spent down the road.
Yeah, I'm glad you made that clear.
That's my issue.
Yeah, I don't want to fall into the cynical well of all the dreads, because even these places that are doing that, people get sober there.
Yes.
And it's because people are helping people. I guess it lingers, the grossness, when I hear the language, like corporate talk. I don't know. It's just not my vibe. But I'm not saying, okay, drain the whole thing. It's not a swamp. But this rise is something new, maybe in the last decade, 11, 12 years. And it's something you don't hear talked about directly or a lot, especially if you work for the treatment center. It's not something they openly talk about. You're talking about 6 or 7 people in a room that work for a large company that are talking this way. They're the business apparatus of it. It usually doesn't reach, God forbid, I hope not, the clinical floor. These people aren't talking that way. And when it does, you'll see that the place starts to unravel. They have to be kind of in their own tracks, but so that's a new phenomenon, especially the internet. How about the outreach of positive messaging and technology? Things have changed a lot since you've been in recovery, and I of language of individual care, that term, meeting someone where they're at. Not this fundamental like barrage right up front or punitive. And you said something to your own experience earlier that maybe they were saying this the first time. Maybe I was ready to hear it the last time. I have a friend that says something similar. He goes, I've been to the nicest rehabs and the worst. Guess what? I think the message was, he goes, the solution might've been the same at both of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it's seeing true. All those changes, language, what the biggest changes is language gets broader. You can't be so puritanical when approaching a different generation. You have a lot of experience working with younger guys and their families. Yeah. What's the first thing you do to comfort a family that's just, okay, my son's been in treatment 3 or 4 times. What are we supposed to do? How do you create confidence and comfort in what you're telling them?
Yeah. So the first thing I do is I relay my own experience. And I tell them, because what changed for me, and also my parents report the same thing, is a small shred of hope. When I first grabbed onto a tiny little speck of hope, and I didn't know I was at the time, that's when things changed. I was like, this could be different. I could get somewhere. And that's what motivated me to like look further and then take action. So I try to give them a shred of hope, and I explain, like, I've been through the same thing. If they said 3 or 4 rehabs, I say, okay, I've been to more than that. And then I tell them that I've also been sober since January 1st of 06. And I don't really say my sober date too much, but it gives them a shred of hope. And then the other thing that I like to share with them is if they'll start telling me, I went in his room and he's got this and that, or he did this crazy thing. And I mean, there's a lot of these crazy things. And I also let them know, yeah, I did things that were similar to that, you know, and usually that calms them down, because I think that even today there's a stigma out there and people don't feel comfortable telling people what's really going on. And I think when they hear that there's other people, that's what happened to me. There's other people that seem like they're well and they're doing okay, that have been through the same thing, that there's some hope and this isn't crazy. And then I explain to them as well that I say, look, this is a disease. I also want to let you know that anything that your loved one or child or son or daughter is doing, you cannot apply logic and reason to it to try to understand it. And this disease is so powerful that the million times that they've disappointed you has nothing to do with how much they love you. And usually, you know, just like that, I try to talk like that from a human point of view and tell them, like, I'm with you. I'm not up here reaching down. I'm down here in the trench with you.
Yeah.
And I can show you the way out, right? I know where the ladder is and we can walk over there. I can help you out with that, you know, and I'm not going to take off on you.
Kirk, I want to talk about this because I do like talking about it. It's socioeconomics.
Yeah.
And they're different for everyone in their variables, A, of their choices from having healthcare to not having healthcare, where they're going to go for treatment, the luxuries and amenities that are there, the quality of the staff. You would think that could buy a lot more, but sometimes it's a real level playing field. There's a lot of great this is a little different sometimes in treatment because some of the best clinicians I ever met are working with the most distressed populations.
Yeah.
It's more of a vocation. Yeah. So I don't see it always being the case there with the product of the clinical program, but do you see a difference? You work with wealthy families, and you've worked with people that are in really distress, and you're kind of taking two pathways to get this person in treatment. What's similar and what's different when you're working with two extremely different socioeconomic classes and that they both have the same problem?
Yeah. So what's similar, if I've got two people who are both ready to get some help, what's similar is regardless of their material possessions and their surroundings, AKA I've had people that were homeless in literally an insane asylum in the middle of Boston, Massachusetts, that were living in a shelter 2 days earlier. And I've had people that are living in condos in Cambridge that, you know, if you saw the price tag, would make your eyes pop.
Yeah.
And both of those individuals, the people suffering from addiction, if they've come to me and they're ready for help, none of that matters. They're both in the same spot. They've got that incomprehensible demoralization. Even though one's talking to me on their phone from a multi-million dollar condo overlooking something and all of this, and the other one's in a mental institution, they both are saying things like, I don't think I can do this much longer. I'm not sure if I want to stick around on this planet. They're in the same spot. And that's this disease. It doesn't really care where you are and what you have.
And when you're working,
just
for a caveat or just focus. Okay. Wealthy families.
Yeah.
And are they do they demand some other kind of catering to, if the family's involved, does it feel like more effort and work? Like maybe I'm talking from a Scranton blue collar experience, but are they asking different questions of value and are they looking at this differently that might have their own stigma involved?
Yeah. So they will try to. And because of experience that I had in the past, and it depends on where you are at as a person when you're dealing with them.
Yeah.
They will try to. Yes, not everyone, but I've experienced that at a higher level with the more wealthy.
Yeah.
And to give you an idea, I've dealt with someone who is probably in the top 20 list all time of Hollywood producers. There's one person, right?
Yeah.
Professional athletes, hedge fund managers whose fortune would again make your eyes pop out of your head. Yeah. What I know now based on my experience is none of that matters to me. And I don't entertain any of those things because I am not looking to gain any more or less from them because they have more money available.
You created a reputation. I mean, the sincerity of crossing those levels, like you said, I mean, to me, I always tell Larry, the New England fixer, the recovery fixer, because you're trusted across those boards because of your candidness, your clearness. I guess maybe I'm myself overgeneralizing what wealth could look like to someone. Are they demanding more or do they have a different understanding?
You're right about that.
Yeah.
You are. It depends on the person on the other end.
Yeah.
And, how about this? Catering to those demands, if it means that you really think you can help their loved one and it's going to get them to pull the trigger and get their loved one in your care because their loved one is suffering and needs help.
Yeah.
Then I'll meet any demands as long as they're not changing the what I'm administering to this person, what I've agreed to administer to this person. Like I'll give you an example. I was in a situation where I had somebody who was extremely wealthy that I'll pay you for a year and, you know, blah, blah, blah. They tried to come down and like buy their child a vehicle on a credit card, you know, this kind of thing, day seven. I'm like, what are you doing? You know?
Yeah.
And making demands. And what happened was the demands, I was actually shielding this person from their parents.
Yeah.
They couldn't take it anymore. The kid couldn't take it anymore. It's like, help me. I'm like, this is your safe zone. And that helped this kid respond to what we were trying to explain or show or teach. But anyway, you know, when the demands got to a point that they were trying to change the experience we were trying to create for this kid that we know works, it was proven.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, okay, we will pack up his things and you send me a plane ticket and we'll send them home.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, Joe, I've done that many times. I've never had anyone take me up on that. They retreat immediately.
Yeah.
No. Okay, relax. I'm like, okay, so let me do what I'm doing.
And at this point, establishing, I'm advocating for one person, it's your son.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not here to cater to you or your needs. The transition's already happened. I helped you get through this stabilization, this intervention, and now it starts, but I only advocate for him, the patient.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that has to be jarring for them when they think, okay, well, this is our son. This is our, you know, and now someone's advocating for their son as his own voice. I think that's really interesting and probably is helping produce the person he may need to become in recovery. Someone's showing him a way out to be autonomous.
And don't forget, and I don't want to sound because there's many people that, you know, people don't get well. A lot of people don't get well, you know, but don't forget that in that dynamic, the person who's making demands of you, that approach that they're taking actually already hasn't worked. That's why their loved one is with you.
Yeah, I'm laughing because it's like this is where you can use logic. Like, let's break down logic. Let's show you what has failed, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Kirk, I'm winding down. Any last ideas or things to tie up? What are you up to recently? What would be a parting message to people that could be listening that are in distress and not for themselves directly, for someone they don't know how to speak to or begin this process?
Yeah. So yeah, if you are if you have a loved one that's struggling, just know that you are definitely not alone. There's about 28 million people in this country alone over a period of a year that could use some kind of treatment. And what you have to do is reach out and get help from someone. Reach out to someone who either you trust or that knows somebody that they trust that knows about addiction and treatment, and talk to someone. You're not alone, and that person can then help you deal with your loved one and help them get to treatment, and then they can help you help yourself as well. Because that's another thing: the people around the sufferer also get sick. There's no way around that, and they need help as well. And there's people out there that are willing to help. I'm one of them, and I my purpose in life is to help someone who needs help, or help someone that has a loved one that needs help. That's my purpose in life, and I'm available for that, or I can plug you in with somebody.
Well, that's a beautiful purpose, and I'll leave some information in the show notes. Kurt, it's great seeing you, man, and I'll be talking to you soon.
Joe, thank you so much. I'll talk to you soon.
I'd like to thank you for listening to another episode of All Better. You can find us on allbetter.fm or listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and Alexa. Special thanks to our producer, John Edwards, and engineering company 570 Drone. Please like or subscribe to us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. And if you're not on social media, you're awesome. Looking forward to seeing you again. And remember, just because you're sober doesn't mean you're right. Hi, this is Joe Van Wee, your host of All Better. I had a few announcements. If you're interested in subscriber content, which we're about to launch, this would be STEP workshops, cognitive behavioral therapy tools, and mindfulness practices that are approachable and can be very useful in reducing anxiety, rumination, and depression. Please send us a message on Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn. And if you like the episodes that you've been hearing very much, please stop by Apple Podcasts. Give us a 5-star rating and a small review. This helps us stay relevant in the field of content and helping people and their families with substance use disorder. Thank you.